Hey there, this is Erica Kelly, and you're listening to Southern Fried True Crime. Today I have another special guest on the show, Dr. Peter Vronsky, who is a Canadian author, filmmaker, and investigative historian. He holds a PhD in criminal justice history and espionage and international relations. He's on the show today to discuss his upcoming book, Sons of Cain, A History of Serial Killers from the Stone Age to the Present. This is his third book on serial killers. He started in 2004 with his book, Serial Killers, The Methods and Madness of Monsters. And then my favorite, Female Serial Killers, How and Why Women Become Monsters, which came out in 2007. In Sons of Cain, he is coming full circle with his first seminal book on serial killers. Peter came to study serial killers after a chance encounter with Richard Cottingham, the torso killer in the 1970s in New York. His new book is both a more comprehensive look and yet also a broad look, going back to the dawn of man to today's monsters and putting them in the context of the time periods that produced them. So pour yourself a sweet tea or a whiskey, sit back and relax, and I hope you enjoy my chat with the incomparable Peter Vronsky as much as I did. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Erica. Thanks for having me on.
It's really great to have you on. I've been a big fan of yours for a long time.
Oh, thank you.
How are you feeling about this new book?
I'm very excited. And of course, you know, this is my third book, so you never know, right? So still a lot of trepidation and waiting anxiously for August to see how people react to this book. But so far, it's been good. It's up on Goodreads. Some people have been reviewing advanced copies. People are enjoying it, so I'm happy to hear that.
Well, I have to tell you, I loved it. I was already a fan of your previous work. A lot of times when you get these sort of books, they're, I would almost call it like an encyclopedia of serial killers. They don't read very easily, and you read as writing fiction almost. It's an easy read. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, well, as a historian, you know, I like his stories. You know, I'm not like a structural historian, like about the theory and dynamics. I enjoy telling a story, a narrative. You know, I'm kind of that old-fashioned kind of historian, a narrative historian. And true crime, of course, is all history and all narrative. And, you know, every crime is a little history of its own. I enjoy approaching the subject from that narrative kind of dimension.
You perfectly encapsulated it. As a podcaster, I also have a degree in history myself, and I consider myself a storyteller and a historian more than I do an investigator, obviously. What you do is completely different, but I love your work. It's so interesting. Were serial killers always a passion of yours? Because I know you had a long career before that.
My story is that I never heard of the term serial killer when I had encountered my first serial killer quite randomly in 1979. From that moment, after that brief encounter, I always wondered what these things were, you know, and it occurred before the term serial killer had been coined. So I had this very brief encounter with Richard Cottingham, the Times Square torso ripper, as he was fleeing a hotel in which he had set two torsos on fire. I was checking into that hotel, and we collided for maybe 10 seconds at most in the lobby as he was fleeing the scene. And so from that point on, I wondered, you know, what the hell was that, right? And so the first book that I picked up to read about that phenomenon was Anne Rule's The Stranger Beside Me. And of course, that book didn't have the word serial killer in it either. She too was writing before they coined the term. That book comes out 1980. So I still am left with that old school appreciation and perception of serial killers as we saw them long, long time ago as kind of Alfred Hitchcock movie monsters, as, you know, these strange types of killers that used to be called recreational killers, thrill killers, sex killers, psycho killers, pattern killers. We didn't really have a word for them until the New York Times, essentially, begins using the word in spring of 1981. From that point on, I always, you know, read about serial killers and was interested in, you know, as they became labeled, as they became categorized, as the science of profiling emerged, John Douglas's, Ressler's, and Burgess's book, Patterns and Motives in Sexual Homicide, came out. And of course, that sparked the organized, disorganized FBI profiling system. So, you know, I've been watching all that as it was happening. You know, the original Mindhunters came after my first encounter. So that's why I ended up writing the kind of books I have, kind of in a historical sense as to what were they before we called them serial killers? And what does that explain to us about the guys we call today serial killers? Certainly kind of the evolution of that phenomenon in our society.
I was going to say, one of the things I just loved was, of course, you go into major deep history, but people don't understand just how dark some of the original fairy tales were. I also have a degree in English literature, so the Charles Perrault references and all of that, it comes from what people had back then that wasn't an understanding that we have now. I love the history of that.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of kind of naive myths and legends and indeed fairy tales often really are a kind of discourse on serial homicide. Except we don't, just the same way as I in 1979 didn't have that concept to identify what I had encountered, people in the past as well didn't have it. And so, you know, I believe that our original werewolves and vampires reflect the FBI's profiling system, the organized and the disorganized serial killer.
Yeah, that was incredibly fascinating. A really neat way of separating them and making it understandable to a layman. I really appreciated that.
Yeah, you know, and when you look at those trials of people who were accused of being vampires and accused of being werewolves, you know, we know, like at least I know, you know, that there's no such thing as a werewolf and a vampire. It's fantasy. You know, I try to look at myself as a sober historian. But in those days, people literally believed that there were vampires and werewolves, and people were accused of being that and brought before inquisitional courts. When you look at the court testimony from the 1500s, 1600s, these trials of, quote, werewolves, and you look at what they did, you know, they're obviously ordinary human serial killers. Their crimes they're committing are the same crimes that Jeffrey Dahmer and John Wayne Gacy were committing, you know. And if you take John Wayne Gacy or Ted Bundy and put him 500 years back, he would have been charged as a werewolf and tried as a werewolf. People could not believe that human beings could perpetrate such horrific, unexplainable atrocities.
So we make these things up for ourselves to make us feel better, almost, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We all want to feel that the world is under control and that we understand what it is and that we are safe amongst ourselves. And I think that's the horror of the serial homicide, why so many people are so obsessed with it and fear it and why it's so deep in our culture. Because, you know, unlike aliens that come from somewhere else, or monsters that come to you, these are things that come out from us, from our own society, from our neighbors, our teachers, our husbands. You know, they're amongst us, monsters that we can't really see that turn, you know, on a dime, especially if you're a woman. Certainly it seems that, you know, because of the nature of society, you know, there's a greater fear of these monsters from women, while the men fantasize about being that. It's a sick society we live in.
Well, it's interesting because the statistics for people who consume true crime, of course, they vary, but basically it's usually about 80% women, 20% men, at least for podcasters. My audience oddly skews a little differently, but I honestly think that's why, as a woman myself, that I was always fascinated. I've been fascinated since a young age, and it is a little bit of what can happen to you rather than a fantasy of what I could do.
Absolutely. There's something about fear that keeps you attuned. You know, it's statistically a rare fear, But it is a realistic, plausible fear. Do get killed by serial killers and abducted by serial killers. It happens. In the same way as I nonchalantly collided with this serial killer, people's paths cross. For me, it was not a dangerous situation because I'm not the kind of target that he had, you know, been acquiring. But for the two women that he had encountered about 6 hours before my encountering him, it cost them their heads, literally. You know, he beheaded them in that hotel room.
And I appreciate that perspective on that. Oh, I meant to mention earlier, too, I'm also a fan of the podcast Murder Was the Case and your friend Lee Miller, and listened to your interviews with him. And Lee said something the other day about he understands that when he's walking behind a woman on a deserted street, that she has every right to run and be scared. And that a typical serial killer would be the only one that would chase her, really. That, you know, that he wouldn't, but that he understands that fear.
That's right. Absolutely. There is that kind of power balance on the street. There is that, and of course, for the serial killer, what they're seeking is a kind of a control. So fear is what essentially, with what they begin, you know, asserting their control with, either overcoming that fear or blitzing beyond the ability of a woman to use fear to protect herself. They hone in on that like an animal tracking a scent.
It is. That's a really good way of putting it. I want to get into something that I truly, truly appreciated in this book, which was your comparison of the Great Witch Hunt as the serial killing of women, a genocide of women. That's interesting. I've never heard it put that way before, and I'm kind of shocked that I've never heard it put that way before.
Feminist historians call it a gynocide, but certainly you have, you know, the witch hunts throughout Europe. The majority of the victims that were targeted were women. These were often women that did not conform to society. They were often, you know, single women. They had no protection of the family. They were independent women. They were autonomous women. And so they're now subjected to these obscene, what I would describe, nothing but rich serial killing, where in the name of, again, fighting this kind of supernatural enemy, the devil that is supposed to use female sexuality to corrupt male-led society, and therefore women who are seduced by the devil must be made to confess their sins and even under torture and then have their bodies destroyed by these freelance torturers.
And it was very sexualized.
Absolutely. And yeah, because exactly. It's all about sex, right? Because they're the devil's concubines. Everyone fears sex and the power of sex, especially if an autonomous woman wields it. So she has to be put down, and her sexuality has to be attacked. And here you have this kind of hysterical moment, you know, where these two great religions are clashing and trying to purify themselves and show each other, between the Catholics and the Protestants, who is the most righteous, who is the most pious. Well, let's see how many women's bodies we can break to show our piety. So you have this kind of mass serial killing sanctioned by the state and by the church.
That was basically a pissing contest between two religions. No, I mean, that's definitely making light of it, but that's kind of what you said there. Like, that's disgusting.
Yeah, it's precisely that. It's a gynocide in the sense that it targets women, right? Unlike a genocide that, you know, will target, you know, race or religion or creed. I think that the witch hunts are very comparable to the Third Reich's perpetration of the Holocaust, where you have multiples of men, you have an entire bureaucracy that are required to kill in the same way serial killers kill. They're the state. It's state serial killing, in that they'll kill a victim, and then they'll come home, they'll wash up, their wife may wash the blood out of their uniform, they'll play with their kids, they'll read the newspaper, they'll go to bed. The next morning, they go out and they kill two or three more victims. And so the witch hunts were very similar in that process. So I think there is this phenomenon of state-sanctioned serial killing. And, you know, while the Holocaust was racialized, certainly the witch hunts were very, very sexualized. That state serial killing more in the kind of traditional association we have with serial killer as kind of aberrant sexual pathological crime.
Right. That was going to bring me to, I always love a good literary reference when you talked about Jack the Ripper basically being the Moby Dick of serial killers. I liked that, and we can kind of get into that, and he leads me into the less dead as well.
Right.
I like your description of that, because we have something we call in podcasting the missing white woman syndrome. I'm not quite sure who coined that. I'm sure you're very familiar with it, but that's what the less dead reminded me of.
Jack the Ripper, of course, is when you think of serial killers, you think of Jack the Ripper, and often he's classified as our first modern serial killer, although less so these days, but again, traditionally, we often saw him as even our first serial killer or our first industrial era serial killer. And he's certainly our first celebrity serial killer in the sense of this global sense. And part of his celebrity, of course, is that he's never been identified. That's the biggest part of it. That he might have or might not have written letters to, you know, the newspapers and to the police taunting authorities. That is, you know, we'll never know. We've never definitively been able to say that those letters were authored by Jack the Ripper. So that, you know, leaves us a question as who he was and what he was and Ripperology and this fascination and the fact that, of course, he's committing these crimes in the newspaper capital of the English-speaking world at that moment. You know, there are more newspapers in London than in New York, so he's hot in print media, and people have just learned how to read, and paper has become cheap, so everybody is reading for entertainment, and what they're reading about is true crime. The Penny Dreadfuls, you know, all this literature, it's all about crime. Even the old hand-printed pamphlets were often about crimes, you know, that's where I found those old werewolf stories. So Jack the Ripper is huge in that sense. And, of course, the mystery of who he is or who he was.
And that's actually what makes him Moby Dick, because of the mystery.
Yeah, exactly. Who was Jack the Ripper? And, of course, there are all these wonderful theories that even that he was another serial killer. You know, the latest is that he was H.H. Holmes Chicago, stuff like that, right? Or he was, you know, related to the Queen, or he was this famous artist or famous surgeon and so forth. You know, historically, if you look at the kinds of crimes he had committed, he's very likely to be of the same class that those women were, the local storekeeper maybe, you know, but a resident in Whitechapel in that area, not far. So he's not, it's unlikely he's even a middle-class guy who's slumming in Whitechapel. He's probably from there.
He's more or less a typical serial killer like we would have now. Yeah, I think people have put him up on some sort of pedestal thinking that he has to be from the high class or royalty or whatever. But to me, at least, kicked off the less dead syndrome that you speak of by targeting prostitutes.
Yes, in a way. Because, of course, with industrialization, prostitution is industrialized as well. You have these massive now populations of prostitutes that you didn't have before. It's interesting because what I kind of trace in my book is like, who were serial killers targeting before prostitutes? So I find that there are in multiple countries that are just beginning to enter industrialization, you know, before you have that mass of urban populations, especially when factories were in smaller villages and further away from large urban centers, it was servant girls because there was this enormous influx into the cities of servant girls to now work in the growing middle classes that are profiting from managing these factories, counting, you know, the owner's money, the lawyers, the physicians, various managerial people. You have this middle class emerge. Still don't have, though, that destitute urban population of the proletariat, urban worker, and mass destituted populations inside the cities as well, who are unemployed. So servant girls are ubiquitous, and associated with the servant girls, I also noticed that there's this kind of fetish for the clothing that they wore, for the kind of jewelry that they wore. And so I see all these pre-Jack the Ripper serial killers that are essentially killing these women for their clothing, collecting their clothing as trophies. They murder these women, and inevitably there are servant girls. And, you know, people would have looked down at servant girls the way later society looks down at the prostitute in the same way. So they're kind of discounted members of our society, and serial killers are kind of circling them like sharks sniffing out blood in the water.
And the fetishism of the servant girl, I mean, it lasted into modern times. You can still go into any costume shop and get a maid's costume.
All those fetishes, including, you know, inquisitional witchcraft dungeons, you know, dungeon play is still going back 500 years where they were really, you know, having forcible sex with female victims in those medieval dungeons. And so it still echoes in kind of our sex play to this day, 500 years later, you know. So what else is echoing in our society, in our brains, in our fantasies? Because it's not just serial killers that fantasize about dungeon play. It's a kind of a very common middle-class fantasies. Husbands and wives play at it once in a while on a weekend.
Right. And you get into that into the last chapter, which I don't want to spoil or get too much into, but that was interesting to me that maybe that's why we are evolving, is because as a society, we're a little bit more open-minded.
Exactly. So, we're coded going back to the Stone Age, essentially. You know, our basic human coding is to survive by either running away or attacking danger, running away from danger, attacking danger, eating and having sex. That's all we used to do at one point, for at least maybe as long as a million years. We killed anything that wasn't like us. You know, we would have sex with anybody we wanted to, and sometimes we would eat them if we needed to. If we can't run away from it, we're going to kill it. So 20,000 years of civilization compared to a million years of that kind of anthropological behavior, our brains are not going to be free of that yet. We're kind of like albino frogs, you know, that have been jettisoned out of the dark of the earth and now are just getting light, but we're going to be albino creepy frogs for a while longer until somehow our brains weed that old impulse out. You know, my argument basically is that we're all born serial killers and that serial killers are unmade rather than made. You know, every child is born potentially a serial killer, but, you know, fortunate parenting, lack of trauma, well-adjusted life, and probably some X factor, which we still have not identified, weeds most of us from emerging as serial killers. And what remains are the serial killers, the other deviants that stalk our society. I mean, there's other evil other than serial killers, but it's all kind of this predatory, sexualized, culinary hunger that drives everyone.
But, I mean, that's what I exactly took away from your book, is that it is that X factor, and then that's the only way that it's going to change for the future. But I'm not sure that they'll ever completely be eradicated, no matter what kind of technological advances or anything, because I agree with you that it's encoded in our DNA to a certain extent, right?
Yeah, and it's not exactly DNA even. It's some kind of certainly biochemical process that still eludes us, you know, the kind of the genome. What is it that makes us? Let's say that if we don't get metaphysical about it, you know, what is the soul? What makes us evil or kind or good? It's probably a set of switches in our brain, a kind of chemical switches on and off, probably something very binary that can be coded, that, you know, the way we react to our experiences from the moment we're born, and perhaps even in the womb, we don't know, but there's some kind of chemical coding going on that is our soul. And if we can extract that, that's who we are. We're not the flesh, we're that chemical code. And I imagine a future where we will be able to extract that. We will understand what switches need to be turned off to, you know, prevent aggression or prevent unwanted or warranted aggression. All those things inside us are surely must be chemical.
And that's so interesting. And I also really appreciate the hopefulness you leave because of that, because you understand that you still leave room for hope.
Absolutely. I'm very hopeful about the future, that nothing catastrophic will happen to humanity in terms of kind of an intervention, Colorado caldera blows, right? Or we're hit by an asteroid, you know, something like that, of course, is some horrific catastrophe.
Right.
There seem to be less serial killers today. And we don't understand why, but we believe that somehow it's associated with a general drop in violence overall. There is as well more awareness in law enforcement of serial killers. As I say, in 1979, a serial killer was unimaginable. We didn't even have that word. Certainly guys in the FBI were beginning to use it, but they were the only ones who were kind of aware of that. So there's certainly a higher awareness now. So the big question is it because we've kind of arced out of a historical cycle that brought us this surge between, you know, the golden age, between the 1970s and 1999? Is it just our media perception? Is it that we're better at capturing serial killers and apprehending them and identifying them? Certainly DNA technology has broken a lot of cases over the last two decades in a way that we could never have done. Serial killers are more often getting caught with fewer victims. The average age, the average number of victims has now declined for serial killers. You don't have those super numbers like 40 victims, 30 victims, you know, 36 victims. That's becoming much rarer. That's one issue. The issue, of course, as well as I kind of related the so-called golden age with the Second World War. In particular, the children raised by the Second World War generation, by the adults of the Second World War, and especially returning veterans and the world that they had returned to, the literature of that time. Because, you know, we've all been trying to understand why this rise, this dramatic rise of serial killers in the late 1960s through the 70s, 80s, into the 90s, it was just unprecedented. You know, something like 70% of all serial killers that we know of in the United States emerged in that 30-year period. And we often associated it with what was currently happening in society at the time these serial killers began killing. We were associating it with the disorder of the 1960s, you know, the race riots, the collapse of trust in the government, the sex revolution, all those things, the hedonism of the 1970s. The problem is that most serial killers are seeded very early in their childhoods, when they're, you know, some as early as when they're 5 years old. And so I began to think, you know, all these guys of Ted Bundy's generation, you got to back them up 20 years to look at where they were when they were 5 years old. And of course, as soon as you look at the golden age serial killers, you begin to see men who were boys during the Second World War and following the Second World War. So you need to look at who their fathers were, what the male generation was like back then, and of course the trauma of the war, which are, you know, the men who fought in the Second World War, unlike, you know, American soldiers and with Vietnam and subsequently, they could not acknowledge at that point the horror of the Second World War. You know, you didn't have a free press covering the Second World War the way the Vietnam War was covered. That brutality of that war, we shared at home. We saw it on television. Unfortunately, a lot of Americans took it out on the soldiers who had to endure that war and fight in it. And perhaps if we hadn't done that, we would have never diagnosed PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask too, because we didn't even have the psychological framework to understand what those men had been through at the time.
Exactly. So that's why I think that as you're looking at, you know, the sons of the Vietnam War veterans that are coming of age in these years, I think those veterans at least had the territory of PTSD to retreat to. There was treatment. And so perhaps those families had a better chance, not in every case, but had a better chance of reconciling with the traumas of the fathers. not in the case of the Second World War. And the Second World War, much more brutal than the Vietnam War. This was a total war, right? So what our soldiers
had... People forget that, too. They really do.
Yeah, yeah. And so what our soldiers had to do then, without PTSD, is horrific when you look at it now, kind of with a colder eye from that period, as, you know, to the point that we weren't even comfortable talking about it when the majority of the Second World War generation were still living. You know, now there's very few left. Many have passed away and passed on. So it's almost safer for us to talk about essentially our grandfathers now, what they had to go through. And it's a little easier to say what was almost a taboo to say, what they were forced to do and what they witnessed and the kind of aberrations of that war that they must have brought home with them afterwards. And so somewhere, I hope some graduate student will look at, you know, the hard data on the fathers of the Golden Age serial killers, how many served in combat, you know, because very often it's just not there in the accounts, in the histories. They never get to the father.
In the data now, yeah, and what we have now. I really like that too, that little shout out in your book to whoever's reading. Please look into that. And it also, that leads into the fantastic title of your new book, Sons of Cain. I put out just a screenshot of the cover of your book and the title to my listeners, and oh, they went wild. They love the name, they love the cover art, everything about it is great.
Yeah, the first great mass murder, of course, Cain and Abel, and is that really all about, you know, our Stone Age clash with the Neanderthal. So in that sense, we're all sons of Cain in that essence. But certainly serial killers are, we're certainly not the sons of Abel.
That's for sure. Well, I think that's probably a good place for us to end on. I don't want to give too much away about your great book. I will say that the one that got me started on you was your female serial killer books, because people just, at the time, didn't look at them as closely, and that's the first one I grabbed, and it made me go back and get your first book.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, my first book kind of ends in the same place. It kind of begins in the same place where this book ends, with Richard Cottingham in New York. And of course, I've met him now since Sons of Cain went to print. It kind of ends on my being called by the daughter of one of his victims. She's searching for her mother's severed head. And so Cottingham is kind of helping with that. He wants to not necessarily make amends, but he wants to put his things in order, his affairs in order, as they say. He's now in his 70s. He's not in very good health. And so the daughter of one of those New York torso victims contacted him, and together we went to see him, and now I'm essentially working on his biography now, kind of. This is my first serial killer, and maybe this will be my last serial killer, as I'm writing about him and Jennifer Weiss's search for her, you know, the head of Dita Godarzi. Where is that head?
Well, I like that, though. That means you came full circle. That's really neat.
It feels that way.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. I really appreciate you coming on the show today, and I'm so excited for people to read this book, because I absolutely loved it. I think it's going to be something that's studied and taught, but for lay people as well. It's not just for academics, and that's what makes it so readable and approachable. I appreciate that.
Oh, thanks, Erica. That's great. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed doing this. Anytime. Glad you enjoyed the book, and thanks so much, Erica.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too. Take care.
Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. As always, if you enjoyed the show, tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on Stitcher and many other apps. If you're interested in supporting the show, come check out my Patreon page or my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. I also have a merchandise store open at whatamaneuver.net. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media, so just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing this interview or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my main Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.